Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome along. It's Justin Briley with you for your weekly dose of thinking, theology and conversations that matter here on Unbelievable. So glad you're able to be with me for the next hour and a half or so. Got a really interesting conversation for you on today's programme. Quite different, actually, to a lot of the conversations we feature on today's show. I'm going to be welcoming John Mark Comer and Rachel Holmes. And John Mark is the author of a new book called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. Rachel Holmes, as you'll hear, is a Buddhist atheist. And what a conversation it is. Available on video as well from our YouTube channel. If you're on YouTube, just look for Unbelievable with Justin Briley, or go to our webpage and access all of the stuff from there that you need. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Past archive, loads of resources. You can get the Unbelievable book. And of course, links to events. And the big one coming up is Saturday, the 9th of May. Central Hall, Westminster will be there for Unbelievable, the conference 2020. But will you? I hope you will be, because you don't want to miss this year's conference. How to tell the greatest story ever told. We're looking at that big story of the life, death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. How did it transform the world then? How can it still transform the world today? We've got first-class speakers in the form of N.T. Wright, the well-known theologian and New Testament historian, Tom Holland as well, who'll be bringing his wisdom from his new book, Dominion. Fantastic to get both of them on stage together as well. I'm sure we'll be doing some stuff where they'll both be engaging with one another. And of course, Ask N.T. Wright Anything live edition as well of that popular podcast. So do book your seat now at unbelievable.live and look out for the live streaming options we're going to be adding soon as well to allow you to attend the conference and the Ask N.T. Wright Anything show from anywhere in the world. But if you can be there in person, always best to be there in the room. Unbelievable.live. Loads of other great speakers as well that we've announced over at the website. Jess Lester, Ruth Jackson, Sarah Lumger. Really glad that Bobby Conway, the one-minute apologist, is coming all the way over from California to be part of this year's conference. And I'm sure we'll get him on the show beforehand as well to tell us a little bit about his ministry. And listen out for our very dramatic promo for this year's conference later on. Again, unbelievable.live. Get yourself booked in before the early bird tickets run out, okay? They won't be around forever. Big shout out before we get into today's conversation to Emmy Susan Samuel. Had this lovely tweet from her. Said, unbelievable, my favourite podcast out there. Hosting people from so many different spaces. Conservatives, progressives, atheists, apologists, complementarians, egalitarians. Ensures that there are ping pong balls going off in my head every time I listen. Hope we can get a few more ping pong balls rattling around on today's show. Thanks for listening, Emmy, and I hope you enjoy what we've got for you today.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Today we're talking about the ruthless elimination of hurry. We live in a digital age with more information, resources and opportunity at our fingertips than previous generations could ever have dreamed of. And yet, by almost all measures, Western society seems to be producing more tired, more stressed, more anxious, more depressed people than ever before. So what's gone wrong? How do we fix it? John Mark Comer is one of my guests on today's show. He's the pastor of Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon. He co-hosts the podcast This Cultural Moment with Mark Sayers, and he's the author of several books. His latest is called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry, and it examines the hurry-sick, anxiety-prone, tech-addicted nature of modern culture. And Drawing on his own experience of finding a new way of living, he invites those who are unsatisfied with their life to get off the treadmill and rediscover the way of Jesus. Well, Rachel Holmes is my other guest. Rachel was a participant over 7 years ago, I can hardly believe it's this long, in our atheist prayer experiment here on Unbelievable, where around 70 or 80 atheists took the challenge to pray daily for God to reveal himself to them over a course of 40 days. Now, if you want to go and revisit that, it's somewhere back in the archives, I think November 2012. Rachel grew up in a Christian household but lost her faith, and she might sort of tell us a little bit about that again today, and has been quite open on her blog about struggling at times with depression and illness. But she's here really today to engage with John Mark on this modern malaise of hurry and anxiety, and what, as a non-believer, how she's sought to find peace and what she makes of his suggestions for a healthy life. So it's a great pleasure to have you both, John Mark here in studio and Rachel on the line as well. Thanks both for being with me today on the programme. Before we come to Rachel, John Mark, someone who hasn't been on the show before, but I feel like we kind of know each other a bit.
I know, I'm a long-time listener, so I know. I'm really happy to be here.
I was so thrilled when I discovered that a few years ago, that you have been a listener to Unbelievable.
Oh, I love it. You know, a podcast like this would never fly in America. It's too rational and reasonable and non-polarized.
That's very kind. But
I love it.
We seem to have a lot of listeners as well in the Portland area, I have to say, which
really?
Is obviously where you're a pastor. We, of course, went out in 2018, did an Unbelievable conference at Westside
right.
Jesus, where I think you were the pastor at one time before.
Many years ago. Yeah, we planted out of there. Yeah.
So there's lots of connections, but it's lovely to have you in studio. And when I saw that you had this book come out and you might be in the UK to do some talking about it, I thought, it's not the normal kind of thing would feature on Unbelievable, let me be honest, but I really want John Mark Comer to come on the show. So this was my excuse.
This was your excuse, and poor Rachel, I feel like I owe you an apology and we haven't even started.
No.
Rachel, let's just introduce you as well briefly before we hear about the book from John Mark. Can you believe that? Over 7 years ago that you were on the Atheist Prayer Experiment?
I know, yes, it was towards the end of 2012, I do remember that. And it was a very interesting experience for me. I know I had some experiences during the experiment, which I think probably some of your listeners and maybe even you thought, yes, that was God, you stupid woman. Why did you not recognize that? I'm not sure how you'll feel about this, Justin, but that experiment set up by you was kind of instrumental in me becoming a Buddhist.
Really? I didn't know that bit of the story. Wow.
Oh,
okay.
Well, I'd say I'm secular Buddhist. I'm not, yeah. I'm very, very unconvinced about things like rebirth, and the more far-reaching implications of karma just seem to be plain old victim blaming to me. But Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. But it did change my life. So even though I didn't become a believer, it did change my life. And part of it was very much what I appreciated about the slowing down in the morning, just to have that prayer for God to reveal himself to me, and then a time of just sitting and waiting. So it kind of ties in with John Mark's book and his ideas.
Well, that's really interesting, and I'd love to talk a bit about that in the course of today's programme. Just for the benefit of those who can't recall or haven't listened to that Atheist Prayer Experiment set of programmes we did, I remember at the time you basically said at least once when you were praying, a voice came to you and said, do you want me to help you with your sadness? And that you felt a thought, as you called it, dropping into my head of, well, be thankful. And as you say, I think a lot of people would have said, well, if you want God talking to you, that's a pretty good example of God talking to you. But you didn't feel you had to interpret it in that kind of way.
I didn't. I was, and I guess I still am, open to the possibility that it was. But I think also when you get quiet, you can tap into a deeper wisdom. And I felt it was more likely that it was that. But I wouldn't completely discount the possibility that it was God, but I understand those of your listeners who might have thought, duh.
Well, look, we'll get to some more of sort of how that has manifested in your life, what some of the challenges are that you face, and how you see your own sort of spiritual practices, as it were, helping in that. John Mark, if we come back to the book, and I have to say, I've been reading it, and my wife as well, and we've both found it incredibly helpful, very challenging as well, because it's quite a drastic kind of call to essentially live very differently to the way our technologically driven, fast-paced culture kind of demands of us, isn't
it? Yeah, against the inertia of culture right now.
Exactly. And this is something, though, that you're writing from personal experience, because you kind of, this book is the result of you deciding something's got to change because my life is unlivable as it stands. Do you want to tell us about what caused that?
Oh, I mean, honestly, we could talk for way too long. I'm not sure that's the best use of our time, but it's the common kind of trope of the early midlife crisis in the Western world. You know, I live in a city, demanding job. I'm, you know, the first generation really to come into the phone as this new, as one person I chatted to recently called it, a human experiment in omnipresence, which, you know, we're just 12 years into. You know, I read another person recently who was saying, you know, people talk about the fear of the cyborg or whatever, and functionally, we're cyborgs already. You know what I mean? We just haven't. Elon Musk is trying to get it into our brain, but we already are.
It's not physically attached, but you could be forgiven for thinking some people are almost physically attached.
Yeah, or is it? Yeah. I'm not sure. You know. So yeah, I mean, I'm happy to go down that rabbit trail if you want. But yeah, I hit a spot about 7 years ago where it was a profound kind of both mental emotional crisis. I have a history of mental illness in my family, and when I was younger. In university, a real clear brush with anxiety and depression and a really dark morass, a number of years of my life where I was really on the verge of, you know, of something dangerous. And so that's all in my kind of neurophysiology and my genetic code and my life experience. And then you compound onto that just the stress of life and work, and then you add in the phone, and then you give a few years for adulthood to just pile over on one to another. And yeah, really hit a profound place of mental, emotional burnout, fatigue, exhaustion. And then below it, really even kind of a deeper spiritual crisis in my own, you know, what as a follower of Jesus I would call spiritual formation, in my own process of becoming more like Jesus. And in doing so, I pray more like kind of my own true self. And I really felt that I was stuck, that I had hit a wall and was really just kind of banging my head against it and definitely not progressing and maybe even regressing under all of the stress. And so it was a real profound kind of early midlife crisis where the gift of those moments is you kind of put everything on the table and you're open to new possibilities that you weren't before. And you just kind of set everything down, work and job and God and all of these things. You set before you, and you know, and there's a beautiful freedom that comes when you can just kind
of interesting
reimagine.
Yeah. So you kind of basically put everything up for grab and said, what if, you know, this isn't the life that feels like a Jesus-centered life.
Yeah.
It's not the life Jesus lived. Jesus was a busy person, though. It's not like he didn't have much to do and could
absolutely
just sit around. But at the same time, you were aware that he didn't move from a place of stress and anxiety and the rush. It was always something that came from a different place.
Yeah. So when I use the moniker of hurry, you know, that's just that means different things to different people. But even the word busyness is, you know, you have to interpret all of this. And so there's a healthy kind of busyness that just means you have a lot to do. Your life is generative. Mm. You're not wasting your life, you know, playing video games till 2 a.m. or, what, you know, on social media all the time or Candy Crush. Like, you're doing something generative and creative and life-giving and beautiful. But then there's another type of busyness that's far more common and I think toxic. What Ron Wolheiser, who's a Catholic writer I love, he calls it pathological busyness.
Mm.
As in it's like a pathogen, you know, loose in our society and our soul.
Well, it's the way everyone answers now to how are you?
Busy. It's what everybody says.
It's like the standard answer.
It's
isn't
the
it?
customary Western answer.
And if you weren't busy, something would be wrong. You'd be lazy.
Because it's a
busy
moniker. It means I'm important. Yes. It means I matter. You know, and part of that goes back to the deeper structures of Western culture, which is built around accomplishment and accumulation.
Sure.
And so who are you if you're not doing something in the world? Your identity is at stake, you know. So I'm busy, and followed by the next question, what do you do? Fill in, you know, career, vocation. And of course, I care about work and generativity. But that other kind of busyness is when you have not a lot to do but too much to do. And so the only way to fit it all in is to hurry, to speed up your mind and your body. And what really matters for me is your relationships and your interactions with God and with other people to a pace that is incompatible with love and with joy and with peace, which in Christian theology are kind of the trifecta of life.
And to what extent do you link, you know, the way that that's accelerated in a way in the iPhone age? I think there are even statistics showing the spike in depression and even suicide and so on young people kind of correlates with the introduction of smartphones.
Oh, yeah, my understanding is that's pretty much agreed upon. Yeah, it's not a question.
And so what's happening there? If we can say it's not just a correlation, there's a causation here. Is there something about us being constantly available to these devices that is doing something to our soul, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, and that's where you'd want to have a neuroscientist on, not a pastor. But yeah, I mean, everything I've read has said, yes, absolutely. There's no question the link between the phone and anxiety. But it's deeper than just the blue screen or addiction, you know, because it was a problem before the phone.
Yeah.
And so, you know, recently I've been thinking a lot about Edwin Freeman's book, Failure of Nerve. He's the one that coined the phrase, a non-anxious presence, and his kind of portrait of the West and its regression into at a moral and a relational level. I'm sorry, at an emotional and a relational level. To a culture of anxiety, in spite of the myth of progress, and that was written in 1997,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And
he's writing things about, have changed quite a little.
Yeah,
since then.
And gosh, that's a decade before the smartphone. So I think you are already at a tipping point in Western culture of anxiety for all sorts of reasons, from urbanization to the breakdown of the family to secularism, and then I think the phone just exacerbated a vulnerability in the human condition. Well, which is what the early founders of Facebook attempted to do.
Yes, I think that was their whole thing, was how can we make people stay on their devices for as long as they possibly can and earn us the most amount of money?
There's
it's not an accident.
No, it's billions upon billions of dollars. Economists call it the attention economy. They make money off of our anxiety and our addiction.
Well, we're going to talk about some of the steps, some of them quite drastic in a way, at least for modern people, to the way you've at least decided to change the way you live life with your family and your recommendations in the book for others. Rachel, coming back to you, tell us about sort of your response to the book overall. You've only had a chance to just read it quite quickly, which is ironic, obviously, given it's a book about
the irony, Rachel. So sorry.
I know.
That's my fault for not giving you much notice. But do you kind of agree with the diagnosis, let's say, that John Mark has in this book about culture currently?
Yes, I do think we are far too hurried, and that it is causing a great deal of malaise. I mean, there was much in the book. I mean, I tried to focus on what I agreed with because I thought it would make for a more pleasant and productive conversation. But in general, I can endorse the overall message, even if, not being a Christian, I'm not on board with the fundamental sort of Jesus part of it. But yes, to slow down, to take time, that hurrying is incompatible with a deeper appreciation of life, of being present to the people we say we love. That's all rang absolutely true. I found myself laughing with how much I identified with some of the things you said, John Mark.
You're welcome.
What were some of the things you identified with then, Rachel?
Oh, with just the constant hurrying and trying to multitask and how impossible that is because you just end up doing everything badly. The constant sense of anxiety and feeling like you want to run on to the next thing instead of being fully there for the thing you're doing. There was a lot that I identified with. And funny, it actually came to me, I thought, I know there's a quote that I want to get. And this was Blaise Pascal. All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. And that was in the 1600s. I mean, imagine how appalled he'd be if he was out back here now.
I know.
So, where you're sitting alone on our phones and catch up on Instagram.
Exactly.
I mean, this is
one of the things. And I was having this thought before I read it in your book, but your book sort of confirmed it for me, that as Christians, I think we pray less because we have phones in our pockets. So every moment that you're in a queue, walking down the road, whatever, phone comes out, check. It becomes your instinctive. Whereas we might have used that opportunity to pray and so on. And this is where it's changed me. I've consciously made the decision. I'm not going to get my phone out on the train. Let's try and do something.
Because
that we
those
used to
moments
do here.
Really matter, and they've all been swallowed up now by the digital carnivore.
And I'm going to ask you to be kind of frank here, Rachel. But what's your relationship with your iPhone or whatever form of technology you
use? I wouldn't say I am addicted. I think, like probably most people are, I don't tend to get it out on the train unless I'm listening to something rather than going online. But that's still a distraction.
Sure.
But I think probably with the practices I have done, the Buddhist practices, I know that some of the greatest joys I've had on public transport is sitting on a packed tube carriage doing what's known as loving kindness meditation for the other people in the carriage, where you sort of breathe in and then breathe out is, may you be happy, may you be well, may you be free from suffering. And it's just much more wholesome, but that doesn't stop me getting the phone out sometimes.
No.
And, going onto Twitter, which is very toxic.
Well, it can be. I mean, these sort of social media platforms, like it or not, are set up to kind of draw you in and waste, you know, inordinate lengths of time arguing with people you'd probably never met or really have any relationship with. But,
exactly.
But, I asked the question of you, I would freely admit to a kind of low-level addiction that I'm only now, I think, getting to grips with. Because I think a lot of us, it's crept up on us, this smartphone revolution, hasn't it, John Mark? It's not something we were prepared for, and I think people,
and there was
only
no
now,
societal wide conversation about whether or not it's, you know, smart or intelligent way to live or sustainable, or just, you know, because there's an agenda with it to make money off of us.
Now it's really interesting to hear about, obviously, where you've got to yourself, Rachel, in terms of the things that you're finding helpful. Just was fascinated just by that example you gave of the what did you call it, the kindness,
loving kindness meditation. It's one Buddhist practice, and I don't do it nearly as much as I know would be good for me, but it's a way of cultivating friendliness and goodwill, and you can do it anywhere.
And so, is that something, I mean, given that I'm assuming you don't believe that having that does necessarily sort of supernaturally affect the other people around you, is it just more for you rather than for them ultimately? What's the connection?
It's to cultivate a feeling of openness and warmness towards other people. It's part of a number of practices where you can cultivate also compassion and what's known as sympathetic joy, where you feel delighted in other people's joys. They are about cultivating wholesome qualities within yourself, and they will of course spread out into the world. If they're blooming in you, they will show in your behavior.
Again, feel free to share as much or as little as you want, but I know that you've been fairly open about your own struggles with depression points, and you've come through some pretty major medical and health issues as well in the last year or two. So you had cancer, and how did you deal with that? Were some of these meditation practices and so on something that helped as you were going through chemotherapy and everything else that was involved in that process?
They did. I mean, it wasn't my first brush with serious illness. So I've had 3 kidney transplants. You know, let's forget life insurance. No one will touch me. But yes, I found they did help, because I could. I mean, not all the time. You know, I'm only human. But some of the time I could be with my pain and my fear without being absolutely sucked under by it. And I think that's something I've learned through meditation. Here are these feelings. I can give them a cuddle. I don't have to be drowned by them.
Yeah, let them pass through. Rachel, do you find that in this area, and I'm so sorry to hear about your cancer.
It's okay. It's clear now. It's gone.
Oh, God, what a gift. Do you find that in this area of kind of some of the practices, the mindfulness, the slowing, do you find, with your background in Christianity or whatever you want to call it, do you find a lot of crossover and common ground between some of the practices of Jesus and some of the practices, such as that beautiful one, which I'm a fan of, I love it, how do you experience that?
There is a lot of crossover. It's funny, while I was reading your book, I was thinking, oh gosh, this reminds me of a book I read in the 80s. What was it? And there you named it. About a few pages later, it was Celebration of Discipline.
Wow.
Because I did use that book some of the time when I was still a Christian. And yes, of course, there is a lot that was in there that there's a lot of crossover. I mean, I'm sure from your perspective, it's fundamentally different because it's not Christ-centered. But there is nevertheless a lot of the things about, you know, slow down, breathe, appreciate, and
compassion,
and simplify, and yes, exactly. So there is, so as I say, I guess from your perspective it is fundamentally different because God's not in it. But from my perspective there is a lot of commonality in that you are trying to be with what is at a deeper level, and pay attention.
There's a Quaker writer from a century ago named Douglas Steer, who recently I was reading some of his work, and he defined prayer as to pay attention to the deepest thing I know.
And that's really interesting.
I love that way of thinking about prayer. And yes, I mean, I think there's a fundamental difference in that, you know, for me as a follower of Jesus, prayer is first and foremost a relational experience. And, you know, obviously in the Buddhist tradition, it's different. But there is that same attempt to be fully present to the here and to the now and to the deepest thing I know and the experience of how does that engender compassion and wisdom in us, you know?
Yes. So I do find there's crossover. And have you read any Anthony DeMello? I haven't, but I understand he writes a lot about awareness from a Christian perspective.
No, I was thinking of the novelist Don DeLillo. No, I've not.
No,
I was thinking Zero K. I don't remember anything about Christian practice in that at all. No. It was very prescient of Western.
And you're a guy
the
who
Don DeLillo I ever read just made me scared about landfill. Yeah, Underworld. That was it.
I mean, just to come back to the issue of spiritual practices, because this is kind of having set out the problem, if you like, John Mark, in this book. You do then sort of give the way that you think Christians need to approach this, and it's about getting back to the way of Jesus, not simply believing in Jesus or the doctrines of Christianity,
but
there's a way of life that Jesus modeled. And when we read the Gospels, we're not just reading his teachings, we're seeing something modeled for us.
Yeah, it's why most of the Gospels are stories.
Right, exactly. And so what does that look like in your life? What changes did you make, and are you advocating that if people want to get serious about living this Jesus way of life that they should make? And then we'll compare and contrast that with some of what Rachel's been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, I think I grew up in a church tradition where there was much more emphasis put on belief and belief as defined by kind of the Western psyche than there was on lifestyle, you know? And nobody would have said that doesn't matter, but the emphasis was more on Bible and theology and ethical, you know, kind of stuff. So it's what to think and what to believe and what to do or not to do, all of which it matters. But I think that has to come out of a lifestyle that's built around the pursuit of, for me, a relationship with the Trinitarian community of love that we call God. And so a core idea that I pick up when I'm reading the Gospels is, you know, the Gospel writers use this Greek word hados, which is translated way or road or path, which is interesting, very similar language to the Buddha used. And it's a word picture for kind of a way of life, a road or a path that you follow to move you forward toward what we would call the good life in Western culture, what Jesus called life in the kingdom of God. And so that's a really key idea for me that I think we've lost in the Western church since the Reformation, that the way of Jesus is not just Bible and theology or what to believe or how to live. It's not just ethics. Those are both very important, but it's also how you live. It's a way of life, and that's the only way to make sense of so much of the Gospels.
I mean, one key part of that is Sabbath.
Yes,
so
very key.
The idea of having a day of rest. It's there right from the beginning of Scripture. It's
all over the life of Jesus.
Something Jesus would have done. Something we've kind of, I think the modern church has in some way said, well, it's rather legalistic now to keep the Sabbath. But you're a big fan of the Sabbath, and you've taken it very seriously and quite literally. You guys switch off on your Sabbath day, don't you?
Like technology. Yes. Yeah. Everything goes off Friday night. It's 6 p.m. Yes. Everything. It's done. We're 24 hours free. It's lovely.
And what difference did that make when you started doing that with your family?
Oh, a major one. And again, that's not like a biblical theology. The Bible doesn't say anything about iPhones. It says a lot about attention.
Yeah.
And a lot about what we give our attention to is the person we become, which is where theology and neuroscience are in complete agreement right now. But that, you know, we moved into Sabbath slow because, again, in the church tradition I came up with, that wasn't really on the radar. Well, I say that wasn't on the radar. We never would have used the language of Sabbath. We would have thought of it as a Jewish thing or an odd fringe thing. But yet, most Protestant Christians and Catholics all had a category for what, you know, most would have called the Lord's Day.
Yes.
Many would have called Sabbath, you know, Wilberforce and others. Like, there's a strong tradition in the West of Sabbath. But often was just called the Lord's Day, which meant something until the 1960s or 70s. Like my dad, who's, you know, 30 years older than me, so he's 69 years old. He grew up, or I was born and raised, in the Bay Area of what's now Silicon Valley. Nobody called it Silicon Valley in the 1950s. And he tells me stories about Sunday where the entire city shut down. Nothing was open. everybody went to church. You were either Protestant, Catholic, or neither, and you went to a mainline church. You know, when and his family was kind of in this fall, he had no faith in God, no understanding of Jesus, but they would still go to church. And then the rest of the day, you'd eat lunch, you'd hang out, if you were super progressive, you'd go to the park and play baseball. You know, and he tells me about what a big deal it was when 7-Eleven came to town, and now there was something that was open on a Sunday. You know, and so I think it's easy for us to forget. Andrew Sullivan's done some great work in his article, I Used to Be a Human Being, for The Atlantic, which is worth 15 minutes of your time to read. It's fascinating, on kind of the death of the Sabbath in Western culture. Because even if you were not religious, the Sabbath was still built into the cultural architecture. Sure, it was literally, in my country at least, I don't know about here, but it was in the legal code. The blue laws, and it's illegal to open a business.
It's certainly dissipated now to the extent that, a Sunday is very little difference in practical terms to any other.
No, it's no different than Saturday. It's shopping, and maybe a little quieter in the morning, but yeah.
And it's gone in lockstep with, obviously, the march of technology, which means even those times when we could switch off from the office, you can't necessarily now, because there's an expectation
you'll always be
connected.
Everywhere your phone goes.
And everything else. We're hitting our first break already here, right? But I'm going to come back to Rachel in just a moment's time as we continue this conversation shortly on the ruthless elimination of hurry. My guests are John Mark Comer and Rachel Holmes. This is Unbelievable, bringing you an episode looking at the hurry-sick, anxiety-prone, tech-addicted nature of modern culture and what can we do about it. Two different perspectives with me on the show today.
His coming was prophecy, his teachings revolutionary, given sacrificially, resurrected in victory, his life has made history. The story of Jesus is the greatest story ever told, yet many today have forgotten how it changed the world. Premier's Unbelievable Conference returns with renowned Bible scholar N.T. Wright, historian Tom Holland, Ruth Jackson, and hosted by me, Justin Briley. Learn how to tell the greatest story ever told to today's generation. Don't miss Unbelievable the Conference 2020 on Saturday, the 9th of May. Book your early bird tickets now at unbelievable.live.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the show. We're talking about the ruthless elimination of hurry. That's the title of John Mark Comer's new book. It's all about the hurry-sick, anxiety-prone, tech-addicted nature of modern culture. And drawing on his own experience, he invites those who are unsatisfied with their life to get off the treadmill, rediscover the way of Jesus. He says it can have transformative effect. It's a challenging read, though. I've been reading it myself. And I think many of us are only just starting to realise, as we were saying, just how much things like smartphones have changed our life. And even before that, we weren't very good at stopping and praying. So it's even harder now. Rachel Holmes is also on the line. As someone who was a Christian at one time, no longer, but says she's discovered ways in which she has found peace and calm in the midst of a difficult life situations through Buddhist practices. Rachel, coming back to you, within the kind of path that you're now finding some help on this, would you say that before you adopted the Buddhist sort of way of doing the introspection and meditation and so on, that what difference has it made, I suppose? Would you say that your life is better on that basis, or not necessarily materially better, but you handle the situations that life throws at you better because of these practices and so on?
Yes, I would say that I handled them much better. Obviously, it's speculation because I don't know how I would have handled them had I not followed this path. But yes, I'm less flappable, although having said that, and I hope it's all right for me to mention this, Justin, I have ended up on antidepressants again because after having got through the cancer a few months later, my partner and I separated and I had to leave our home. And that was quite emotionally devastating after what I'd been through earlier in the year.
So sorry.
But even then, thank you. Thank you, John Mark. It has still, I think, helped me. And I don't think it's reasonable to expect these practices to make you superhuman. I mean, there were times over Christmas where I would just sob over the washing up. But I was able to be with those feelings and have them. And at times they were overwhelming. But you know, they will pass. These things are impermanent. They're not going to kill me, however much they hurt. And I think that's something that the practices of mindfulness and other types of meditation have helped me learn. And, you know, I'm not going to lie, it's been really horrible. Mm. And I'm much more stable now. And how much of that is due to time, how much to my practice, and how much to SSRIs, I do not know. But I would say I think they have helped me to manage things better, but that doesn't make me superhuman.
No. I'm sure you wouldn't want anyone to think that just going into the practices in your book, John Mark, would necessarily create some smooth, calm, perfect life.
Oh, no, buy my book, and you too can never be sad again.
I mean, it's interesting to hear. How much overlap is there in your view, John Mark, between the practices that have helped Rachel and the ones that you're advocating, at the heart of which is, of course, prayer as well, which kind of is
right.
the center point of many of the spiritual disciplines that you outline in the book that help us to order our lives in ways that stop the hurry and get us connected again with God. So where's the overlap?
Yeah, I mean, it's and again, I actually have great respect for a lot of Buddhism, and I think one of the reasons it's doing so well in Western culture is because it's really more psychology, in my understanding. Rachel, I'd love to have you speak to this, than it is spirituality. It's kind of religion without God, which works quite well, I think, in Western culture. And there's some obviously major differences, you know, mm-hmm. particular around spirituality. You know, the tradition that I'm a part of is first and foremost relational. And so that's missing, but there are some really profound similarities. And I think, you know, in biblical theology, there's this idea of chokmah, or the word we translated wisdom. And in biblical theology, it's not just like, you know, a pithy saying or street smarts. It's this idea that we've lost since the Enlightenment of moral knowledge and relational knowledge and theological knowledge, that just like we can have knowledge of the physical universe, the law of gravity or the laws of thermodynamics, you can have knowledge of the way that relationships work and interpersonal things work and generosity works. And so there's this tapping in, which is why the Proverbs are full of little aphorisms from all sorts of pagan cultures and non-Jewish cultures. There's this celebration of chokmah wherever you find it. And so I think that much of Buddhism is tapping into that chokmah, that wisdom, that reality at the center of the universe, not just at a physical level, but at a moral and an intellectual and an emotional and relational level. And I think one of the subtle but very similar things still, though different, is, you know, in Buddhism, there's so much talk about non-attachment and kind of coming to where your emotions, let them pass through you and come to where they no longer own you or control you. And there's a long-running tradition, you know, kind of stream in the way of Jesus. Ignatius of Loyola is the founder of the Jesuit order. He is, you know, kind of my favorite teacher on the subject. He called it, most people translate it indifference, but that's a weird English word. And the translation of Spanish, some argue a better word is freedom. The French mystics called it detachment. You know, Christian psychologists often call it yieldedness. But there's this internal emotional place and mental place that you come to in prayer where you come to just kind of release the illusion of control. I read recently that the average Western person has 15% of the control over their life they think they do. Hence the neurosis all over Western culture.
Yeah, yeah.
15%, you know, and so we rage and we manipulate and we bully other people and we endanger ourselves in an attempt to notch that 15% up. But best case scenario, we get to 17, 18.
I mean,
you know?
I often feel personally when I pray, the main benefit very often is simply that for a little while I stop thinking about myself.
Yes.
And that's that kind of...
That is no small thing.
Yeah, exactly. And you realize how little you often do that most of the time.
And but, the freedom and the joy that comes through that, you know?
So the natural question that maybe someone would have if they were skeptical would be, well, great. It sounds a bit like that aphorism that, you know, we don't pray to change God, we pray to change us, sort of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, and that's not what I'm saying.
So what's the difference then between prayer as a sort of meditative, taking the focus off yourself kind of activity, which looks quite similar to a Buddhist kind of approach maybe, and what's specifically Christian, I suppose,
Yes.
What's the difference?
Well, I think, you know, prayer is, people forget, is an incredibly broad spectrum of experience with God. So often, in particular, Protestant Christians will hear the word prayer and think of one type of prayer, which is asking God to do things in the world, which is a prayer that feels from the inside more like work. And I think it is at a theological level. I think prayer in that, you know, if you want to call it intercessory prayer or just asking God for things, is kind of a, you know, one theologian I love writes that prayer is a moral responsibility, meaning we actually partner with God and work with God through our own imagination and creativity and heart and generativity to see the world move forward towards shalom and human flourishing. But that doesn't mean that all prayer is asking God for things any more than all relationship between two partners or a father and a daughter or friends is all asking each other for things. That would be a really dysfunctional relationship. There's a type of prayer that feels far more like resting in God. And I think that, you know, what we would call contemplative, that kind of contemplative tradition or meditation, which is in some ways very similar. You're quiet, you're alone, you're attempting to still your thoughts. In other ways, very different. You know, I mean, I think maybe this is a gross oversimplification and Rachel speak to this, but in my kind of understanding of the subject, the major difference between Christian and Hebrew meditation and Eastern meditation is the goal for us is less to empty our mind and more to fill our mind, and not just with ideas or images, but with a relational experience of
that's
God.
An interesting sort of way of distinguishing them. Yeah. I mean, when you in the practices, the Eastern sort of Buddhist type practice that you undertake, Rachel, do you even talk of it as prayer? Is that a word you would use, or would you say more meditation or something like that?
It isn't a word I use, but there are quite a lot of different Buddhist traditions, and some of which do sort of think of gods or devas, and they do pray. It's not part of my experience, and obviously there are many different types of meditation. I don't know whether it's so much about stilling the thoughts. Some types of, it very much is about that, but it's kind of, even when you're doing that, it's to shut down the stories about what's happening and be with what actually is happening.
Well said.
So it is, it's you know, it isn't a take me away into a trance, which is, I'm not saying that's what you said, John Mark. It's just I have found that kind of misunderstanding amongst some people.
Right. Yeah. But that, that's not my perception at all. Yeah.
No. But you're quite right that it isn't relational. And actually, one of the things that separated off what's called the Mahayana school of Buddhism from the Theravada tradition was the Mahayana people said, well, it's all very well you sitting there wanting your own enlightenment, but what about the world? What about everyone else? And there's something within the Mahayana tradition called the Bodhisattva, which is I dedicate myself to the liberation of all beings. But even then, the meditation itself is not relational in the way that, you know, for a Christian, prayer is.
Yes, and drawing.
Because
Saint Teresa, you know, 16th century Spanish mystic and just fierce woman. You know, she called this type of prayer silent love. And, I mean, that's my favorite type of prayer. I mean, it's just sitting in the quiet before God in silent love, receiving love from God, giving love back to God. And really, my hope is that there's the pleasure of just that experience, the experience of love. But really, I think the end goal, the telos of the spiritual journey in Jesus' mind, as best I can tell, is to become the kind of person who is pervaded by love, not just compassion, but agape, as Jesus would define it, to will the good of another ahead of your own, no matter the cost to yourself. And as best I can understand, again, where biblical theology and neuroscience, I think, agree, based on my, of course, limited understanding, is that we become more loving by experiencing love, not just by hearing about it or reading a book about it or downloading a podcast. It's the experience of love through our family of origin or a lover or a friend or, for us, above all, God, that does something in the inner woman or man of us to make us into more loving people.
Just be interested in that sense then. Let's say that I'm going to be the person to try and create a little bit of friction.
Finally,
you're going to be the bad guy.
Trying to earn your paycheck.
Far too much agreement going on here.
So I can't get us to disagree about love and compassion.
No, come on. terrible things.
But if I could play devil's advocate here, then if, say, you know, Rachel's experience is having broadly the same effect as your experience as a Christian, John Mark, of contemplative prayer, someone might say, well, hey, does it matter then in the end? What's the difference? And, you know, I could imagine a skeptic even saying what you conceive to be, you know, a relationship with God, John Mark,
right,
is actually pretty well explained by the psychological impact of simply stopping, resting, and doing what Rachel does as well. Who I'm assuming, Rachel, you don't feel a need to have a supernatural dimension to what's happening there. You feel there's probably a kind of material, psychological kind of explanation going on.
I would say that, but I'd be interested to come back to that after John Mark has
responded.
Answered.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Well, what difference then does it make whether you're doing it Rachel's way or your way, John Mark?
Well, I mean, that's a hypothetical scenario, and I have no way of measuring, you know, which prayer is working better or which form of meditation is working better, and we're two different people and two different experiences. I also have no way of measuring, you know, where God is involved in Rachel's life, and she's open to that possibility, you know?
Saying that, I guess from your point of view, you wouldn't say that God is absent in the things that Rachel is doing. God's doing something, even if Rachel doesn't
necessarily... Are you trying to theologically trap me?
I'm not trying to trap you. No.
Presumably,
all truth is God's truth if something good is happening, God's not somehow completely absent.
Yes, and you know, we're so prone to the subject-object dissonance. You know what I mean? God is out there. We are here. You know, when I have an inner feeling or thought in my mind, it's me, not God, or it's my brain or my nervous system or my memory or my limbic system, not God, as if, you know, those two things have no interpenetration. And, you know, I will just plead the mystery of the universe, you know, cop out card. And I am 100% orthodox and historic in my reading of the Bible and my, you know, trust in the New Testament. And so this isn't some kind of, you know, hint or nod to a progressive, you know, update of the New Testament or whatever. But in my best reading of the New Testament, I think you can hold to a historic orthodox view of Jesus and the cross and the resurrection and atonement and still have wide space to celebrate a God who's so much broader than that tradition and who is by nature compassionate and is at work. And you see that from the very first pages of the Bible in the Melchizedek story. Mm. Who's not a Hebrew, you never read about him again. Where did this person come from? Who's in relationship with God, who's a mediator between God and people. And so I think, you know, there's a celebration through the – I don't think it's not the main portrait. The Bible is told through the story of Israel. Mm. But outside of that tradition, you know, without compromising any of my theological or doctrinal kind of convictions, I have no problem thinking that a compassionate God of love is loving Rachel as she's open to the possibility of his love, you know? Mm. And so that's why it's just hard to measure. One, she's a different person than I am. Two, we all start from different places and different mental and emotional places. And three, who knows where this compassionate God of love is at work and we don't know it. I know there's all sorts of areas in my life where I think God is at work and I'm ignorant of it all the time.
I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth either at this point, Rachel, but I'd just be interested to know what you think from your perspective as someone who doesn't necessarily, you know, believe in the supernatural, is actually happening in John Mark's experience when he has an experience of what he would call feeling the love of God and the way that changes his life and the way he lives and so on.
And I wouldn't just say feeling the love of God. I would say experiencing the love of God. Yeah, yeah, I'm actually a pretty cognitive person. I struggle to feel. I'm trying to get more in touch with my emotions. I think there's a... I would distinguish between just feeling and experiencing.
Okay. But what do you think's going on for you, Rachel, at that point? And how does it tally with the kind of experience you have when you slow down and meditate?
Well, I think, like John Mark, I would be very reluctant to say anything about what might be happening to him for the same reasons he gave when speaking about me. But I don't know. It's when I sort of slow down and meditate, there can be very many things. Sometimes it can be very painful. Things will come up that are uncomfortable. I become, and this is something that John Mark actually mentions in his book, become aware of my dark side. The ugliness in my character, and other times I will be filled with a lightness and joy. It's, you know, these things just just arise. And I do think it is psychological, but it's allowing me to tap into things that are much deeper than I would be able to touch into if I were just sort of scooting along without taking that time to be still and to be quiet. But the one thing I wanted to mention when you spoke to me before, Justin, was that I had very powerful emotional experiences when I was a Christian. I mean, I grew up, I was a teenager in the 80s, and charismatic Christianity, as well as the sort of discipleship kind of thing, were going on. And during that period, my kidneys were getting worse. I was anticipated to have a transplant. And many, many people prayed for me. And obviously, I didn't get healed. But I did have very powerful emotional experiences of release of what John Mark said and what I interpreted it as at the time, of being absolutely bathed in divine love. And it would be far too easy for me to reinterpret those experiences in light of what I now believe. But I do know they were very powerful, and they had transformative effect, whatever they were caused, whether it was by God or by something psychological. I would not discount the meaningfulness of those experiences.
I mean, it does lead me to the next natural question then, Rachel, if you don't mind me asking it, of why did you ultimately then abandon Christianity if you had had quite powerful experiences within that? Obviously, you didn't see the healing you had hoped. Was that part of the reason why ultimately you left Christianity?
It was part of the reason. I mean, the reasons I'm now not a believer aren't the same as, well, not completely the same as the reasons I lost my faith initially. But yes, I mean, the not being healed was a very big thing. I mean, I remember very vividly the night I sort of woke up in the middle of the night, and it was just sort of, oh, I don't believe anymore. Because I just had my second kidney transplant, and it looked like that was going to fail. And I just thought, you know, if all these people have prayed and I've just continued to get worse, I've lost one transplant, it looks like I now may lose my second, then what does that mean about God? Does he exist? If he does exist, does he just not care? And I know you can pull apart these arguments, but that was kind of the sort of, it's sort of like snapped, something snapped in me. And I think I realized that what I had thought of as my faith by that point had become a sort of cognitive attachment. It had actually, you know, the corpse was already there. I just, oh, it's dead. I should probably get it out in the garden. So that was what initially did it. I mean, I've thought about and been through many phases in the interim. I went slightly bananas after I lost my faith because I didn't know right from wrong. The Bible had been the only metric by which I could judge it. Without that, it's like, oh, I don't know. So yes, I had a wild phase, and then, you know, hopefully come back to something more sensible. But yeah, that was what initially triggered it.
Yeah.
But I've certainly gone from being wildly, no, there is no God, to I don't think there is, but I am open to the mysteries of life.
Right. That's so helpful and very honest. Thank you,
yeah,
Rachel,
thank you for that,
sharing.
The pain of the kidney thing. I mean, I can only imagine what that must have been like. I'd love to hear.
Carry on.
No, I'd love to hear. You mentioned the reasons you're not a Christian now are different than the original ones. I would. Can you explore that? I'd love to hear why.
I think at the time I find it hard to tally Christian belief with what I perceive as being the reality of the world. I find something as contradictory, but if you put me on the spot, you know, I'm just going, oh God, I don't know. It's been a long time since I've really thought about these things.
God, sorry, not my intent.
Specifically. I've gone from being very angry to being much more reconciled with my past and the good things that I got from being a Christian, as well as the things that were painful. I still have a very complicated relationship with hope.
Hope.
Anyway, that's getting off track a bit.
Well, it's all relevant in some ways, and I appreciate you sort of humouring my question as to what it was that took you away in the end. And I suppose, I mean, it takes us on to a slightly different topic at this point, John Mark, but I guess as a pastor you see people who are in, have been in similar places to Rachel, who are in all kinds of different situations, and many of whom have experienced disappointments.
Yeah.
What do you find how causes people to either abandon the Christian way or stay in the Christian way? What are the things ultimately that help people to see this as even when things aren't getting healed and life isn't going the direction we might hope, that keep people actually believing in this as being the way that life ultimately can be lived and can be hopeful?
Yeah, I mean, I think out of honor for human dignity and individuality, I hesitate to put some kind of rubric over this is why people abandon the Christian faith, or, you know, here's who we blame, or it's rebellion, or it's this, or it's, you know, whatever. I think that is unkind and unwise, and I think every person has their own story. And, you know, what's intriguing about yours, Rachel, is that your loss of faith came as your kidney was failing. And, you know what I mean, it wasn't just this cold-heartedness or some desire to just, you know, abandon all ethics or whatever. You know, it was a part of this intricate and tender kind of suffering. And I do know that, you know, there's much, I think, bad thinking and bad theology in the Western Church around suffering and around pain. And I think there's a few things about the way the Western Church is set, and that's a broad overgeneralization that's almost unhelpful. And the Western Church it's low-hanging fruit to criticize because there's nobody there to defend it. And anything that any Christian has ever done wrong in the West, you can say, see, there, they were a Christian, you know? So if we applied that same rubric to, you know, democracy or whatever, I mean, you'd have far more fodder for critique. You know, I do think there are a few broad trends across traditions in the Western Church that set people up for a crisis of faith. And I think one of the major ones is theodicy, or, you know, just the academic language for the problem of evil. Yeah. And different Christians have different answers to that. And, you know, you have these two, and I'd love to know what your church background was, Rachel. What kind of church tradition did you grow up in?
It was varied. It was partly Anglican, partly Methodist. And for a brief while, and I don't know if you remember this, Justin, I was a member of the 9 o'clock service in Sheffield, which collapsed in scandal.
Oh, yes, I do. I remember that story.
Yeah.
Right. Wow.
Yes.
Okay. But and there's obviously been a charismatic strain within that, you were saying. So that would have been, would that sort of been kind of John Wimber style sort of healing?
Yeah. I went to two Wimber conferences in the 80s.
Wow. Yeah.
And he was a lovely guy, actually. He was a very, very likable chap.
Yeah, and I'm a fan, 110%. But I think, period. And, you know, I think the two theological strains that I would disagree with that aren't even necessarily what everybody believes, but is the popular perception or what's emotionally communicated to many people is, one, the idea that God's in control of everything that happens, which I think is one of the great heresies of the Western Church. And that's a genuine point of theological disagreement between what's called the Calvinist tradition and other traditions.
Interesting.
And two would be the kind of more charismatic stream that God always wants to heal, which I agree with, and therefore it's you just need enough faith, or you just need the right prayer formula, or you just need whatever.
I think, thankfully, I don't really ever took that one on board. I did hear the, if you don't get healed, it's because you don't have enough faith. I didn't think I ever really took that one
you
on
took
board.
That in.
I heard it, but I just sort of, I think I sort of emotionally rolled my eyes about it. I don't think that one ever really landed.
Yeah.
I was skeptical about it even when I was a Christian.
But
so
I think
he never really wants the critical amount of faith.
Yes, which is wise, and I would be skeptical too. Though I am charismatic, is the insider lingo. Yeah. I think that the Spirit of Jesus heals people, and I think that, you know, what's God in control of, and how does human free will interact with God's presence in the universe is one of the great mysteries and great disagreements of the church in general, less the Western Church. Mm-hmm. But I do think that when we read the Gospels, we read about a Jesus who both healed the sick and then eventually died.
Yeah.
And, you know, the story ends with suffering, with the passion. And whatever the human experience is, it is going to involve a passion, a suffering, a dying. And so I think there's a meeting Jesus in that I think is tragic for many people in my experience have lost their faith, I think, because of some very unhelpful assumptions about the role of God and evil and suffering, and some that were handed to them, if not officially, maybe emotionally and relationally through the broader church culture.
We're going to go to a final break here, and then we'll have just a chance to wrap up the conversation. Been really enjoying today's one. Very, you know, free-flowing, wide-ranging today between Rachel Holmes and John Mark Comer, talking about the ruthless elimination of hurry. I will make sure, of course, that there's links as well to where you can find out more about both my guests from today's show. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable to find out more about the programme, get hold of the podcast and get in touch as well. And we'll be back with the final part very shortly.
The Unbelievable podcast has been hosting the conversation between Christians and skeptics for over a decade. They're sometimes friendly, sometimes feisty, but always fruitful, I hope, in helping you understand faith, reason, and culture. If you enjoy the show, please consider supporting it. It'll help me to continue to create these conversations that matter through video, podcast, and online resources. And as a thank you for any gift you give, we'll send you all of the video sessions from Unbelievable the Conference USA, featuring John Lennox, Mary Jo Sharp, J. Warner Wallace, Brian Brodison, and others. To support the show, go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable and click on Give.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of the show. We'll be returning to the conversation with John Mark Comer and Rachel Holmes in just a minute. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. And it's always lovely to hear from people all over the world who listen to the show via podcast or via the video channel. We'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the show shortly. Last week was Hinduism, religion and conversion. That was, again, a bit of a different conversation to some of the ones we normally host here on the show. I got some of your feedback. Continuing feedback to our trying out different types of music. Now, actually, today's show bumper music, I'm redoing some that I started at the very beginning of January just to see how it goes. A few people seem to like this one. But I'm receiving lots of offers of help as well, which is really great. This is very much a crowdsourced kind of thing as we seek to find the right music for Unbelievable. Just to say that if you're coming back on Unbelievable next week, we're doing a theological discussion, The Problem of Evil and the Love of God, two theological approaches to that. I'm going to be welcoming Thomas J. Ord on the show. He's the author of The Uncontrolling Love of God. He has quite a controversial view of how to reconcile God, love, and suffering. And John C. Peckham is the author of a new book, The Theodicy of Love. So you'll be hearing their two different approaches to that in what should be a really interesting deep dive on the programme next week. If you can stick around after Unbelievable today here on Premier Christian Radio, Peter Linus, the new UK director of the Evangelical Alliance, is going to be sitting down with Sam Hales on The Profile, and that's available on its own podcast as well. You may remember, if you're an Unbelievable listener, that Peter Linus was on this show about a year ago debating transgender issues with a transgender Christian. So if you enjoyed that show, I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing more about his life, faith, and ministry. And before we go back into our discussion, just one mention for the Unbelievable London Discussion Group. It's meeting on Monday, the 2nd of March at 7:30 p.m. The usual venue, the Cock Tavern near King's Cross. And this time, the speaker is Steve Tompkins, PhD in theology, has authored several books on Christian history. His latest is on the English Puritans who sailed to America, the land of the free, on the Mayflower. It's a special anniversary this year of that event. And his thesis on the way that freedom of thought, freedom of religion, things we hold vital to Western society were really birthed by that voyage. So if you'd like to get along, more details over at the meetup.com website. You're looking for the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group in London. What an interesting conversation we've had today. John Mark Comer and Rachel Holmes have joined me on the show. Rachel, an ex-Christian. She would say, though, she's been on an interesting journey that led her to Buddhist practices, ultimately. And funnily enough, Unbelievable was part of that journey en route. John Mark Comer, who's been a long-time Unbelievable listener, and we finally got him in studio to talk about his latest book, The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. As I said, do check the show page for more details about it, but it's available wherever you get books from. And Rachel, as much as obviously you said at the outset look, I don't go with the Jesus stuff necessarily in the book, but I see a lot of commonalities with what I find helpful. I mean, you have found ultimately picking up the book, even as a non-Christian, has kind of sparked some interesting thoughts and helpful stuff in your own life?
It has, and it's made me consider certain things. And I did want to say to John Mark how much I admired your honesty, your humour and your authenticity, and you're willing to really take on this changes to become a more honest, committed apprentice of Jesus. Because I really admire your commitment to that, and that there are certain things in the book that I have been thinking about but haven't really done, and Sabbath is one of them. Mm. I'm self-employed, so I tend not to get a day off. Mm. It's very easy for me to go, oh, well, you know, I'm self-employed, I can do this, that's billable. And I don't find it very helpful.
Yeah.
Because I'm never getting time when there isn't that anxious little to-do list going in my head.
Rachel, have you either read the little book or seen the TED Talk by Pico Ayer? It's a fellow Brit, I believe. The Art of Stillness.
I haven't.
That's fascinating. He is a secular guy who does a tour of like Trappist abbeys and research around Thomas Merton and some Buddhists.
Oh, yeah.
And he makes a case and for what he calls a secular Sabbath, which is basically saying, I'm not a Christian or a Jew, but I think we've lost something that we should not have lost. It's interesting.
Yeah,
that is really interesting. Yeah. I haven't got a pen, otherwise I'd write that down.
Show notes, right?
We'll put it in the show notes. Yeah, absolutely. I'm pleased that you have found the book helpful at some level, because it was always a bit of a... I didn't quite know how this show was going to turn out, quite honestly, Rachel, but you've been such a great guest and so willing to engage and be very honest with your story, and I truly appreciate that. I suppose that the question that I've got, and I forgive me if it's uncomfortable anyway, but is, given where you are now, could you ever conceive that Christianity might be a path you could find your way back to again? Or do you think that sort of, no, that road has been walked and it's probably not ever really gonna happen again?
It's hard for me to imagine it happening, but if you'd asked me 20 years ago whether I'd be a Buddhist, I would have gone, what? I simply don't know what is in the future.
It's not something you're completely closed off to. It sounds like you're not saying that could never ever happen to me, I'm afraid.
I'm not closed off to it, but I find it very hard to imagine that it would happen.
Yeah. I mean, and for you, John Mark, you probably, when you wrote this book, as I say, were primarily thinking of people who are Christians and are apprentices, you know, as you call it, of Jesus in the book, and it's written with that in mind. What about the people who are listening, who are sort of interested in this Jesus way but not convinced about it? Does simply doing the practice help at some level? I mean, does kind of just trying out, if you like, because that was kind of what I was trying with Rachel when she first came on the show.
Yeah, that was
let's just see what happens when you try praying. What actually would happen if you? And interestingly, although the vast majority of people said I found it helpful in a kind of it settled me down, but I don't think I heard God swooping to me. Some people became Christians through it. A couple of people did, and that was quite for me. I wasn't even really expecting that. Maybe that shows my level of faith. But what's your kind of where for you is there a value even in the Jesus thing for those who wouldn't necessarily call themselves Jesus followers in that way?
Yes and no. One of Jesus' most famous teachings is, you shall know the truth and it shall set you free. Mm. And a beautiful idea. A mentor of mine once said to me, you know, as I was just exploring, what do I actually believe? He said, I think Jesus would be the kind of person who would tell you, you must follow the truth wherever it leads. And I like that idea. And so I think what I hear in Rachel's voice and what I want to engender in my own heart is just an openness to truth, to reality, to what is. And my understanding, my experience, my trust is that at the center of what is a Trinitarian community of love and joy and peace that I want to open to. And so I think the practices of Jesus are not just meditative techniques. You know, in the rubric of the way of Jesus, the goal isn't actually to calm down and to settle your mind and to chill out or even to be happier or nicer. It's all a means to an end. It's to open yourself at an inner a relational level to God, to this Trinitarian community of love, and through Jesus and the Spirit experiences love and have God transform you into a person of love for the world as you live in relational connection with God himself. Jesus' famous teaching on this was abiding in the vine, which is Christian language. It sounds weird to a Western ear, but it's one of the most important teachings of Jesus. And it's a word picture for this kind of relational resting in God as we live all through the day and out of that bear fruit in Jesus' kind of agrarian analogy. So I think yes in that. I think no in that we don't do these practices just like...
Just for the benefit.
Just for the benefit and benefits, just to feel better. Sure, and they're not an end of themselves. It's not like...
This isn't just a self-help book.
No, this is not... Yeah, there's self-improvement. I have no problem with self-improvement, but this is not self-improvement for Jesus or Christian self-help. These are relational practices. They are, you know, I have a practice of date night with my wife and the goal is not just to have date night or to feel good or to check the box. It's to relationally connect with my wife. And so the goal for a Christian of Sabbath, of silence and solitude, of slowing, is not just to do these things and feel better. It's actually to relationally connect with God. But here's what I love. I just think that Jesus is true. And I think that the way of Jesus is the best possible way to live. So I think anybody, whether they're hostile to the idea of Jesus or open and warm and kind, like Rachel is, I think try it on. Try the way of Jesus on from the inside out. Try ethically living into his way. Try spiritually living into, like, opening yourself to God and asking for God to reveal himself to you and pervade you with his divine love, as Rachel said. And so I definitely think that you can hold the way of Jesus up against any other tradition, any other religion, any other secular or psychological framework, and I think you will not only find it compares, I think you will find it as the best possible way to be human. Now obviously I'm 100% biased,
right?
You know, and like all the way in.
Yeah.
But I really think that you can try on the way of Jesus from the inside and it will I think it will prove true.
Rachel, I've really appreciated you coming on to talk this through with John
Thank
Mark.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's been real fun. So thank you so much. John Mark, thank you for stopping by the studio.
Such a joy.
It's been great. I'm glad we've been
and
able
Rachel,
to
connect. And Rachel, it's such a joy to kind of meet you, not really meet you.
Likewise.
I still don't know what you look like, but you're lovely to chat to.
You too. It's been a pleasure to read your book.
Great. Well, thank you guys both for being with me. Do check out The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry as well. Make sure there are links from today's show. But for the moment, John Mark and Rachel, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Wonder what you made of today's discussion. You're welcome to leave me your thoughts. Do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Get in touch via our social media as well, @unbelievablejb to follow the show on Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb for the Facebook page of the show. Leave me your thoughts there. I post up stuff regularly as well, so if you follow those accounts, hopefully there'll be some stuff of interest that you enjoy. I'm on Instagram as well as justin.briley. But yeah, it's lovely to connect with people that you do meet through Twitter and that kind of thing. And one of those that I met this week was Glenn Packiam, who lovely guy, pastor out in Colorado, who has been following the show since we had Tom Holland and N.T. Wright actually on the show together. And he was a big enthusiast when he discovered Unbelievable and since discovered the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast and other things that we do. So lovely to get a brief coffee with Glenn while he was in the country. Glad to say, of course, that Tom Holland and N.T. Wright joining forces again at this year's Unbelievable Conference 2020 on Saturday the 9th of May. Early bird tickets available at unbelievable.live, and you can find out about all the other cool stuff happening on the day as we help you to tell the greatest story ever told. And of course, there's been a lot going on in the news over the last few weeks. We don't often cover newsy stuff here on Unbelievable. Britain did, of course, leave the EU just over a week ago. President Trump got cleared of his impeachment hearing. And one thing that has been making news, certainly in Christian headlines and national headlines as well here in the UK, has been the forthcoming Franklin Graham evangelistic tour.
And we've been carrying a lot of news stories here about the number of venues who have now cancelled the booking of that tour. In fact, all eight venues that he was due to appear at later this year have cancelled it due to an outcry from LGBT activist groups. And we actually have had Franklin Graham in here at Premier Christian Radio in the last week. So if you want to find out what he said to us about that, both his apology to the LGBT community and the fact that he's suing these venues who have cancelled him, you can find out more at premierchristian.news. It's the new website for all of the Christian news from Premier Christian Radio, premierchristian.news, to see more with that exclusive interview with Franklin Graham. But causing even more controversy than Franklin Graham's proposed UK tour is, of course, the theme music for Unbelievable. This is the big talking point in the nation right now. David Hazen got in touch to say, "I'm a long-time listener. We met briefly at the USA conference last year. I've never written in until now. But when confronted with a topic of such existential weight and importance, I could stay silent no longer. I'm speaking, of course, about the show's theme music. The options presented so far have been perfectly adequate and, for the most part, would serve you well, in my opinion. However, I think you have a real gem in the theme music for the Ask NT Write Anything podcast. I would love to see that used as a model for Unbelievable. Simple, catchy, and a real recording, not computer-generated. Thanks for all you do." Says David in Portland, Oregon. Thank you for that vote, for something. I guess, what we use for the Ask NT Write Anything podcast is a kind of acoustic guitar-y kind of thing. And it is nice. I like it a lot. That's why we chose it. But everything is in the eye of the beholder, isn't it? Because I've had other people say, "Oh, I hate that Ask NT Write Anything bumper music." So it all depends on your tastes at the end of the day, doesn't it? We won't find something that pleases everyone, but hey, it's only music at the end of the day. We'll try and get it as right as we can, though. Last week's music that we tried out got some responses. The Usurpian said, "The new bumper music is the infamous chord progression, which basically embodies all of evangelical praise and worship music. So maybe that's what you want, but you might be looked down upon by any cork-sniffing music theorists out there. I'll still listen, I guess." So, not rave reviews for last week's music. And Prescott says, "Really enjoyed that last episode on religious tensions in India, but regarding the music you tried out, I'd recommend against that one. The podcast deals with subject matter that is way too sophisticated and nuanced to be associated with the oh-so-simple 1-5-6-4 chord progression." Okay. Message received from the music people who know what they're talking about when it comes to music. A technical question from Dave Edwards, who says, "I'm an old git now, so things have probably changed, but when podcasts first came out, the concept was that if you had an iPod or a device which could play sound files, you could download files from the internet to play on those devices. Increasingly, however, I go to podcast sites like your bigconversation.show and find a list of recorded sound which you can click, and it will play using the speakers on the device you're currently using. To me, this isn't a podcast. It's live streaming sound files over the internet. So I want to know how I can download the podcasts that you say are available in the form of MP3 files or the like. I've yet to figure it out." Well, I'm sorry you've had such difficulty finding that out, Dave. If you do go to the bigconversation.show, there is a link to the podcast. And you should find there links to where you can go to podcast platforms like Podbean, Apple Music, the RSS feed, so that you can simply plug it into whatever podcast app you want to use. And then, yes, you will have the option to download the MP3 files and listen to them anywhere with or without internet signal. And from the webpage of Unbelievable itself, we always aim to make sure that the MP3 file link is there with the show notes. Okay, so I hope you can find it, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We always put the MP3 link because we know that not everyone listens the same way, but we try to make sure that everyone has the opportunity. Last week's show with Deepan and Henry. Deepan was representing the Hindu Council UK. Henry, CSW, Christian Solidarity Worldwide, Christian Persecution Charity, talking about Hinduism, conversion and religious freedom. Now, Eric begins his email also talking about the music, saying, "People who consider the Unbelievable Sanctuary to be a holy place will have a difficult time replacing a good old hymn like EMF's Unbelievable with newfangled contemporary praise song. Good luck appeasing the congregation." Okay. I get the message about last week's song. Not the best one, apparently. But anyway, on to the subject of what we were talking about on the show. You say it seems that the controversy in India is more about politics than religion, more about Western imperialism than spiritual truth. Deep and pointed to Islamic and Christian nations that had the ability to mount conversion campaigns, and contrasted them with the peaceful Hindus, who were more interested in spiritual seeking. Yet, ironically, he also seemed distraught that there wasn't a Hindu nation. I think that Deepin's concerns are appropriate whenever religion becomes a front for the actions of the state. Religion should never be used to confer favours, isolate ethnic groups, or draw national borders. The exploitation of other countries in the name of Christ cannot be excused. It seems a fair concern that India was taken advantage of by Europeans that used Christ as a shield. However, to reject Christianity because of those who used it inappropriately is unfair to the true gospel message. Christianity should be about spreading the good news and not about westernizing the world. That being said, the Christian call to make the world a better place also takes the form of social action, and these sincere acts of compassion could be construed as cultural interference. Vishal Mangalwadi, in The Book That Made Your World, recognized that his Hindu religious system was incapable of making India a better place because it saw poverty, homelessness, and suffering as prices that had to be paid for too much bad karma and not as problems that needed to be solved. And you quote him here, "Cultures like mine had historically resigned themselves to their fate. Western civilization, on the other hand, believed that human beings were creative creatures and therefore could change reality for the better." And back to Eric, "Christianity, on the other hand, calls us to see Jesus in those who suffer." And quoting from Matthew 25, "When I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. And when I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. When I was a stranger, you welcomed me. When I was naked, you gave me clothes to wear. When I was sick, you took care of me. When I was in jail, you visited me." I agree with Deepin that many people promote Christianity with promises of wealth, power, and success. The problem is that this is a mischaracterization of the gospel. Jesus didn't offer a carrot on a stick, but rather a cross for one's back. And while we hope to be citizens of a kingdom where the streets are paved with gold, we also know that the road to get there is a via dolorosa. Christianity, contrary to Hinduism, holds that suffering is the way of salvation and not a sentence handed down by a karma court. One of the reasons that Hinduism is susceptible to conversion is because it is, as Deepin stated, a religion of seeking and not beliefs, a religion content to accumulate as many pathways to God as possible. However, the problem with focusing on pathways is that it makes all destinations irrelevant. Faith for the Hindu becomes seeking but not finding, journeying but not arriving. And while it may seem quite tolerant, it actually ends up cheapening everyone's spiritual quest. It is the vagary of seeking that makes Hinduism largely immune to criticism, but also makes it incapable of changing anything. Instead of seeking the one true God, it covers all its deistic bets by adding yet another one. Instead of focused worship, it ends up just building one more altar to the unknown God. And you finish by saying, "Eric, it'd be interesting to have a debate between a Hindu and a Christian regarding the evidence for their religious views." Well, if you go back in the back catalogue, a couple of years, I think, Eric, you will find that one we did with, I think it was Ken from Reasons to Believe, when he'd done a book on the different worldviews, and that was again with Deepin actually on the other end, where they did more of a discussion on the specific beliefs that Hindus hold. So thank you very much. Always enjoy reading your stuff, Eric. Matthew, a non-Christian listener of the show, says, "I found the latest episode enlightening and also worrying. I think there's a very serious issue here that Christian missionaries simply don't get. For background, I grew up in a missionary environment in Zambia and have family who are descended from active missionaries. The impact on many countries of white missionaries bringing their religion and their way of life is significant and in many cases eradicated local culture and customs, which would also mean the loss of indigenous knowledge. The benefits of better medical care always came with a Bible in the other hand. And when education was given, it was education from the white man's perspective. Local history and knowledge was not included because the missionaries didn't have that knowledge. I'm not exaggerating when I say the effect of missionaries on an area is devastating because it replaces everything with what the privileged white man brings. As it happens, today I've read a blog post by a Kenyan who's reading your book." And by that, you mean my book, Matthew, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Not a Christian. Well, he read the Matthew Paris piece that you reference, and his response is one of significant anger because he's not respected by the words in that Matthew Paris piece. And he sees that same disrespect from the missionaries and their descendants whom he interacts with on a regular basis. So when I hear on your podcast that Christians are doing the same in India, I feel that same anger because coercion is the right word to use when describing missionary work. It's time to call a halt on these activities, says Matthew. Interesting. I'd be interested to see the original post by the Kenyan News site who is criticizing the Matthew Paris blog, of article that I also mentioned in my book, which was an interesting one, who says, as an atheist, it's titled, As an Atheist, I Believe Africa Needs God. And it is a controversial article. So, be interested in reading that. Here's one more reaction to the Hindu discussion last week. Haig Shishmanian in Glendale, California says, greetings from a long-time listener. Was so pleased to see the topic of the last show. Excited to listen, but I have to say a bit let down by the lack of discussion of the worldviews of Hinduism and Christianity, especially regarding their ability to confront the systemic injustice of the caste system, something that seems to be ingrained in Hindu society. As we've learned so often on this show, a constructive conversation about faith or lack thereof must not focus on the outlying bad that people associated with a religion have committed throughout history, but on whether there is a propensity for overcoming that evil, affirming human dignity, and living for good in their religious worldview. Dr. Jacob Daniel, a scholar and friend of mine who grew up in a multi-religious place in India and heads the Heritage Council in Los Angeles, recently completed his PhD thesis at Biola University, Dignity as Respect, a Contemporary Hindu Understanding of Human Dignity. And it would be a great source to consult and invite to the show to discuss the worldviews of Hinduism and Christianity and the concept of human dignity. Justin, I do believe he met you at the Unbelievable Conference in California a few months ago. Yes, probably we did, actually, now that you mentioned that. Haig, thank you very much anyway. Always open to more show suggestions, of course. Last week's was sort of more debating the cultural issues around conversion and anti-conversion law and so on in India, rather than getting to the nub of the differences, the worldview differences between Hinduism and Christianity. Though, as I say, we did do a show along those lines a couple of years ago. You might want to check that out in the Unbelievable back catalogue. We're out of time for your responses, though, for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you can come back again at the same time next week. Don't forget to go to the show page to find out more about today's programme, the show notes and everything else, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And there's links to the video as well over on our YouTube channel as well. And of course, links to this year's Unbelievable Conference 2020, Saturday the 9th of May. Get it in your diary and book yourself in at unbelievable.live. Next up on the profile, it's Peter Linus, the new UK director of the Evangelical Alliance, talking to Sam Hales. We'll find it on its own profile podcast. And next week here on Unbelievable, we're looking at the problem of evil and the God of love from two different theological perspectives. Thomas J. Ord, author of The Uncontrolling Love of God, joins me, alongside John C. Peckham, author of Theodicy of Love. You'll hear their two different approaches to this perennial problem on next week's show. Until then, have a great week. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.